It is April 21st. I am here at Seeley Hall at Smith College for a discussion on the Patriot Act and counterterrorism.
Since 1987, has been the director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Western Massachusetts, is going to speak about the law, the USA Patriot Act, and give a presentation about the origins of the law and its implications. And then Nancy Talanian, who's the co-founder, the director, and the webmaster of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, will be speaking more specifically about the actions that their group is taking and organizing nationally to help citizens become more informed and to organize themselves in response to the infringement that this act implies. And by the way, this Bill of Rights Defense Committee has just been announced to be the 2003 recipient of the American Library Association's State and Regional Intellectual Freedom Achievement Award. Is really making a big difference nationally and making people aware of the implications of the Patriot Act and other issues. So, start. Bill, please come forward and make a presentation.
Well, saying that we discussed the law, I think that's accurate. To say that I'm going to cover it is wrong. The reason is, for starters, the USA Patriot Act is just part of the issue and part of the problem. The USA Patriot Act is this. Okay. This is the single-spaced version. It's 175 pages. The one that went to Congress one Friday morning in November of 2001 was the double-spaced version. It's 350 pages. It was delivered to the desks of your congressional representatives and the senators, the representatives, at about 10 o'clock in the morning. The vote was called for 2 o'clock that afternoon. Congressman John Olbert, who represents not Northampton, although most of us think he still does, said, "I'm going to vote against it because if we're going to have something this momentous, I think that before we vote, we should at least read it." Some of you may recall or have seen the United Nations debate where over the Q Cuban Missile Crisis, where Adlai Stevenson is debating with the Russian representative to the United Nations and says to him in the middle of this debate, "Oh, don't wait for the translation, just answer the question." Well, it wasn't Adlai Stevenson's finest moment, but this wasn't Congress's finest moment, to put it lightly. They never read it. They couldn't have read it. And oh, by the way, it's very complicated, because it's not one law. It's hundreds and hundreds of laws that start section so-and-so and such of the United States Code is hereby amended by deleting after the second line the fourth word, the semicolon, the following, and inserting in lieu thereof the following words, and so on and so forth, and on it goes. This is really fairly complicated stuff. It passed the House of Representatives with 66 dissenting votes. It passed the United States Senate with one negative vote, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. It never went through committee. It never had a report. It never went through any of the traditional congressional vetting processes by which laws are normally reviewed. Now, the Patriot Act, first of all, let's say, it's an acronym, okay? And some of you here probably know what it stands for. If you don't, I'm going to tell you, and English majors, don't get offended. It's an acronym for Uniting and Strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. Why, in the short form, the USA Patriot Act of 2001. Why go through all those convoluted name? Because who's going to oppose something called the USA Patriot Act? The answer, not many people. You also might wonder how it came to be that Congress passed a 350-page law to allegedly combat terrorism between September 12, 2001, and less than 60 days later. And the answer to that is that the FBI, the DEA, the INS, the FBI, the CIA, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and the Internal Revenue Service, among others, had laundry lists of laws they would like to increase their authority so that they can do their job, in their opinion, better, easier, and less obstruction. Less review. That judge is getting in the way of all the good things that the FBI wants to do for us. And so they took them all off the shelf and put them into one bill. Some of which actually has something to do with terrorism. A lot of which has nothing to do with terrorism, but simply has to do with how we live our lives. Now, I thought it would be useful to go over and look at some of the specific provisions of the Act in order to give you a flavor of what's in it. We're not going to do all 350 pages. It's just not possible. But I do think that knowing what is in some of these provisions will at least give you an idea of why the USA Patriot Act is a problem and why what has now become known as Patriot II, also known as the Homeland Security Act, recently proposed by the Bush administration, is worse and more dangerous. And then Nancy will speak about, I think, some of the things that you all can do to try to preserve freedoms such as there are, and to take back some of the freedoms that have been essentially lost through this act. Now, put the cart in front of the horse for just one moment. I want to tell you a little bit about what is in Title II of the Act. It's essentially has nine words. Ten sections. Title II, the second section of the Act, is entitled Enhanced Surveillance Procedures. Emphasis on enhanced. Okay? I'll, let me read you some of the titles, because the titles of the various subsections tell you what's in the act. Authority to intercept wire, oral, and electronic communications relating to terrorism. Hang on, we'll get to the definition of terrorism in just a second. Authority to intercept wire, oral, and electronic communications relating to computer fraud and abuse offenses. Authority to share criminal investigative information. Clarification, translation expansion, of intelligence exceptions from limitations on interceptions. Interceptions being eavesdropping, wiretapping, and so on. Section 206, roving surveillance authority. Not limited to one phone, one computer. Now, any computer, any phone that an individual of interest might use. Duration of FISA surveillance. Don't glaze over. I'm going to tell you about FISA. You may or may not know about FISA. By the time you walk out of here, you'll know as much as you want to know about FISA, and you will be really fearful about a law you've never heard of. It's been around since 1978 through the change of three words. Taken a significant amount of your civil liberties away. Seizure of voicemail messages pursuant to warrants. Subpoena, scope of subpoena for records on electronic communication. Authority for delaying notice for execution of a warrant, which you may have heard of is referred to as the sneak and peek provisions. Come in, conduct a surveillance, conduct a search of your house, your car, and your computer, and don't tell you about it. Pen register trap and trace authority under FISA. Access to records and other items, again, under FISA. Modification of authorities relating to pen registers. I'm going to tell you something about that, Justin. And so on and so forth. All about electronic surveillance, which, in fact, impacts your life should you ever use a computer or a cell phone, or a landline phone, or any other electronic communication device. There was an argument in the Congress about specifically about Title II when it first floated as a legislative idea. And the idea that came from the Democrats was, look, this is pretty horrible. We are essentially abrogating the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures for the duration of this law. And if we're going to do it as an emergency, it should have, the law, these provisions should have what's called a sunset provision. And the sunset provision says exactly that. After 4 years from passage, unless the United States Congress specifically renews these laws, some of them, they expire. The Democrats at 2 years, that's a pretty long time to rescind the United States Constitution. The Republicans said no years, and the compromise was four. 2 weeks ago, Republican leadership introduced a bill into the House and the Senate to revoke the sunset provisions of the USA Patriot Act so that they would be indefinite. Now, I want to talk about, I said I mentioned FISA, and I want to tell you about FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act of 1978. Now, FISA in and of itself is not an evil idea. FISA has a pretty rational idea. FISA says, look, when foreign governments are spying on the United States in their country, they don't have this kind of ticklish, unpleasant obstacle called the Fourth Amendment. So when we want to spy on them in the United States, we shouldn't have to, the United States government, the CIA, the FBI, the DEA, and others shouldn't have to worry about the Fourth Amendment. We should be able to just go and spy. And so Congress passed a law that said when you're exclusively dealing with foreign intelligence, all you have to do is comply with the provisions of FISA, and you, law enforcement, can spy to your heart's content. The USA Patriot Act amends FISA in part by saying, well, the foreign intelligence part of it doesn't have to be exclusive. We can just play a part in it so that any investigation that is arguably related to foreign intelligence now doesn't need judicial approval. It just needs the FBI to certify that it is related in some way to a foreign intelligence investigation. It takes what was a limited law for a specific purpose with a genuine, articulable, sensible rationale and expands it a hundredfold to cover all sorts of routine, non-routine, arguable criminal investigations. And you say, well, so what? I mean, how could anything I do arguably be related to some sort of terrorism investigation? How could my terrorism somehow be related to some foreign government? And that is, all you need is for the FBI to say it. Because the certification from the FBI saying it relates to a foreign intelligence investigation is enough to conduct the surveillance under FISA. Now, that's bad, in my opinion. But while we're on this question of, I'd like to show you what the USA Patriot Act does with regard to a definition of terrorism, which I think you'll find interesting if I can find the right sheet. Let's start with an overview first. This was actually a piece that I stole from Judge Nancy Gertner, with permission, from something that she gave, a speech that she gave at the Bar Association. This is what she had to say. Majority of us clear the Patriot Act was passed in haste. What does this tell us about the government overstepping its boundaries with regard to privacy rights and surveillance? Most of the definitions, or many of the definitions and tools used for surveillance, sufficiently included terrorism and intercepting terrorist communications. And I won't read that. Why don't you just take a look for a second, and I'm going to take out section 802 of the Act. I said I'd show you 802, and I'm going to do that in just a second. I want to also give you a slide on this about FISA. And this defines for you what FISA is. It will change a little, so I'm going to update a little since Judge Gertner wrote this. Seven United States District Court judges run from seven different judicial districts. The Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, excuse me, typo, chooses the judges. Each serves a seven-year term on FISA. FISA is nationwide jurisdiction to consider applications and issue warrants approving electronic surveillance or physical searches anywhere in the U.S. There's a special review court consisting of three judges. The U.S. Supreme Court has final authority over further appeals from FISA. In total, last year, the FISA court had never in its existence, never turned down an application from the government. Never. Oh, and by the way, the only party that appears in front of the FISA court is the government. Nobody else gets to argue. No one else gets to appear. But last year, the FISA court, which had granted thousands of these applications, finally said, We're very disturbed. We're turning down these applications because the FBI committed perjury after perjury after perjury after perjury in 7 dozen cases. They came and they just lied to us. We're turning down this application. And so for the first time, there was an appeal by the government to the Special Appeals Court, where once again, the only party that appeared to argue was the government. And the argument was, well, we don't know how the argument went because it's secret. But apparently it went successfully enough because the Court of Appeals and the FISA Court overruled the District Court FISA and said, yes, and you can have these 7 dozen applications too. We're really not that concerned about perjury. When Judge Gertner wrote this, she said, in fact, no surveillance or search has been denied by the FISA Court. Well, it was, and I suppose they'll never do it again, being the review standard is low. The review standard apparently is virtually non-existent. And the question, of course, becomes, what about the Fourth Amendment? What about your right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures? Not an academic question when we're talking about a college community or a university community. Not an academic question if you use the internet. Not an academic question if you don't want your file, you don't think the government should have a file on every United States citizen and every person who comes into the country. Take a look at this. This is section 802. This should not put you off of law school for those who are thinking of it. But I had a really good law professor who said, look, this stuff is not complicated. Law school is primarily a remedial reading course. And he was right. But I want you to parse this sentence for me for a second, okay? Domestic terrorism. First of all, I'll just editorialize type. We didn't need a definition of domestic terrorism. We have a definition of international terrorism that was in the United States Code since the early part of the century, and it more than covers everything that you would think of as being terrorism. But let's have a new law called domestic terrorism, because it wasn't titled domestic terrorism before. Okay, domestic terrorism means activities that involve acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or any state. Okay? So, you need to have an act dangerous to human life. That could include sitting in front of a bus as part of the civil disobedience, perhaps sitting in a road, because certainly somebody could get run over, perhaps being disorderly, certainly destroying property, certainly getting doing something that might be alleged to have incited a riot, even if it's just talking to passersby. But it's disturbing the peace or disorderly conduct, a 30-day in jail maximum, you could have a criminal law of a state of Massachusetts violated that was dangerous to human life. Okay? Acts dangerous to human life that violate some law. Okay, we're not quite through. You can't be executed yet. Hang on. Don't get upset. And appear to be intended. Look at that for half a minute, please, and tell me in God's name to whom it's supposed to appear to be intended. Because trust me, what appears to be intended to you, to me, and to a United States attorney and the FBI in Springfield are wildly different. Trust me about that. Appear to be intended. Okay? And now look at number to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. So you have to violate some law, it has to be dangerous in some way to human life, and it has to appear to be intended to somebody to influence the policy of a government by intimidation. Which says, arguably, if your demonstration is too successful, You can get executed. Don't worry. It hasn't been used yet. But you might want to think about it. Oh, yes, it has to occur within the United States. The last criterion, the last element of this crime. Now, that, I think, goes to the question, the significant question about your First Amendment right to speak and to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances, rights that you may have thought prior to this moment were fundamental and protected. I think they're fundamental. I'm not sure at all how protected they are today. Now, I want to tell you something that you probably really have not cared much about until this time, and that has to do with telephone tracks. Okay? This is one sentence in the USA Patriot Act. One sentence we're talking about here. Out of the 350 pages, one sentence. And what it does is it amends the definition and asserts language to use pen registers to now cover all electronic communication. Don't go to sleep. This is actually pretty interesting. Pretty scary, too. A telephone tap is what listens to your phone call, okay? A telephone trap is a device that says what phone numbers are going in or what phone numbers are coming out from your telephone, okay? To get a telephone tap, you generally need a judge to okay the search. You need to show probable cause, not need to do a lot of things. Okay? Pretty high legal standard. To get a telephone trap, you don't need buckus. You need to say, I'm interested. Okay? You don't be and there's a reason. Your privacy interest in the numbers is pretty small, allegedly. Your privacy interest in your actual words is very significant. Okay? This law takes the definition of telephone traps, which is a very low legal standard, which almost any law enforcement for any reason can utilize, and applies it to computers. One sentence. You say, well, okay, maybe that's not so terrible, unless you happen to understand computers utilize data. Because when the FBI or anyone else gets your little email message out and your little email message in, they don't get the address, the equivalent of the phone number. They get all of it because it can't be separated. This sentence basically says they can get to your computer for virtually no reason. It's one sentence, and it's also not subject to the 4-year sunset provision. Now, there is a provision later on in this section that says, if the FBI or other law enforcement gets data other than addresses, they're really not supposed to look at it. And as I'm fond when we review this part section of the law, say, this is America, therefore you get to believe what you wish to believe. You can believe that section of the law, or you can know, as certain as the sun's going to rise tomorrow, that it's ridiculous, and of course they're going to look it up, because it's there. And let me just digress for just a second to talk about why they're going to lose it. The FBI is not all the time interested, and law enforcement is not interested in criminal prosecutions. That's not what they want to know. They're not necessarily going to use it to prosecute everyone. They're going to use it to find out what you're doing. They're going to use it to find out what your group is doing. They're going to use it to see what you're saying to someone else. They're going to use it to be able to plant agent provocateurs at your demonstration. They're going to be able to use it to disrupt your group. They're going to be able to disrupt your defense committee in your legal strategy. They're going to be able to use it for a whole lot of really, really useful things for the FBI. If they got caught, using it in a criminal prosecution, well, then maybe they couldn't use it if they actually were disclosed someday and the judge found it and had the guts actually to suppress some evidence seized as a result of it. But if they're not going to use it for a criminal prosecution, it doesn't matter. They can read it all to their heart's content and use it to their heart's content and use it for purposes of putting out agent provocateurs and disinformation, and you'll never know about it. Now, this is the other section, the comment on that section, 216. And I want to talk about it perhaps in terms of one that I don't have here that you've probably heard about, which is the often referred to as the librarian section of the Act. Section 215 is an extraordinary piece of legislation. And I would point out to you that there is a bill in Congress now to repeal that one section of the law. Section 215 says that the FBI or other law enforcement can go to an individual and order that person or that entity to turn over any tangible thing so long as the FBI specifies that the order is for an ongoing investigation to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities. In case you don't know what that means, neither do they. And the difference is, I don't think they care very much. All they have to do is certify that that's what they're doing. The FBI, as a result of this, need not have any suspicion that the person they're investigating is subject to a foreign power or an agent. They need not show probable cause or reasonable grounds to believe that the person whose records it seeks is engaged in criminal. The FBI can investigate any person in the United States based on that person's exercise of his or her First Amendment rights. So the FBI can spy on a person because they don't like the books she reads, or because they don't like the websites she visits, or because she wrote a letter to the editor that criticized government policy. If a person is served with a Section 215 order, that person is disclosing that fact to anyone else, and it is a crime to do so. So if the FBI shows up at the Smith College Library and says, I want to know what Jane Smith has checked out of here, not only is the librarian supposed to give it to him, but if the librarian tells anyone else, she can go to prison. I'm not making this stuff up. Now, there is a bill pending in Congress to revoke Section 215. It has been, 215 is a section that has gotten a lot of attention from bookstore owners and librarians because they don't think they should be telling the FBI what you want to read. And they're right. And so far, it's still very much the law, and so are the other 174 and a half or three quarters pages of the USA Patriot Act. So there's a couple more sections. Now, this puts together a couple of things. Your fundamental right to, first of all, you've got to understand, and I don't mean to have remedial U.S. history here, but I'm going to spend 30 seconds. Your fundamental rights in the United States, applying to all persons within the United States, come from the first 10 amendments of the United States Constitution, basically known as the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is actually is conceptually a very simple list of rights, and it all fits nicely on one piece of paper. The deal that was made to pass the Constitution. 10 amendments of the Bill of Rights in exchange for we create a central government with some authority. Now, Amendment 9 and 10 basically are saving clauses. That is to say, they say 10, not all the rights that aren't specified here are reserved to the states or to the people respectively. And 9 says just because the rights are enumerated here doesn't mean there aren't others. Notice some people were worried about an interpretation, say, just because we have these first 8 amendments, someone's going to come along and say, and those are the only rights you have. So 9 says, no, just because we listed these specifically, just because we think they're very important, it's not because we think that's all there is. The 9th Amendment actually plays a significant measure in some justices' thinking in the abortion cases, for example. We're not too worried about, we're not going to worry about here about the right to bear arms, the 2nd Amendment, and we probably don't have to worry too much about the 3rd Amendment, which is, says that they can only quarter military personnel in your houses in time of war. Okay, hasn't been a big issue since the Revolution. That gets you down to pretty quickly the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 8th Amendments to the United States Constitution, which are about your rights vis-a-vis the government in criminal prosecutions. The 7th Amendment protects your right to a civil jury trial, not unimportant. And your 1st Amendment rights to freedom of speech and assembly and to religion and to assemble and to petition governments for redress of grievances. Your fundamental rights within the country come down to a large measure, the 1st Amendment rights, and your 4th Amendment rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And the reason that the 4th Amendment is so important is because that is the rock bed of your right to privacy. The word privacy does not appear in the Bill of Rights. The privacy is primarily implied by your 4th Amendment right free from unreasonable searches and seizures. The government coming in, looking at your private affairs, looking at your effects, looking in your house, looking in your car, looking in your computer, looking in your mailbox, looking at your library card, looking at your charge slips, looking at all. It is that 4th Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures that is the rock bed of what you think of as the right to privacy. Right to be free from unwarranted intrusions by the government. And the government includes all government, the federal government, the state government, the city government, and all their police forces and all their various branches of law enforcement. When the USA Patriot Act comes and takes, essentially abrogates those rights, you are losing fundamental rights. This act goes on, and I could go on. It says, for example, that used to say, well, if there's going to be a tap on your phone, it's going to be on a phone. But no, now it's going to be on any phone that a person might use. Nationwide roving wiretaps. It used to be that various law enforcement information couldn't be shared. They said, we want to share it all. Well, some information should be shared. But the privacy of the grand jury is something that has existed in this country since its founding 225 years ago or more, and that right is gone under this act. Now, I mentioned before, I think I didn't put up, the sneak and peek provisions. One of the foundations of freedom that you have is when the government intrudes on your house, your room, or your computer, or your library card, it should tell you that it didn't. Because otherwise, how would you ever be able to challenge it? How would you ever know? Otherwise, it's a police state. And it is, in a significant measure, or certainly more significant was in 2001, because under the sneak and peek provisions of the USA Patriot Act, many of these searches can be conducted. The government doesn't have to tell you initially. It can delay it for 30 days, and then it can delay it ad infinitum, as long as it certifies that it's necessary for law enforcement. And you may never know of it. Okay. Now, I'm always invited to do this in 10 minutes, and I always fail. And I'll probably continue to fail. I want to tell you just a little bit about the Homeland Security Act, now pending in front of Congress, otherwise known as Patriot 2. It does, in essence, is it increases each one of these provisions that I've told you about. It expands them and makes them permanent. There is a coalition of the right and the left, perhaps even the center, who is opposing this bill. And it, I think that we have a reasonable chance of defeating it. I would just like to make one final comment, and that is, it's a quote from 1984. I just wanted to quote two pieces of it for you. It says, how often the thought police plugged in on any individual wire was guesswork. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment. And then it goes on to say, he says in another portion, does. In a physical sense, war involves very small numbers of people, mostly highly trained specialists, and causes comparatively few casualties. The fighting, when there is any, takes place on the vague frontiers whose whereabouts the average man can only guess at. Foreigners were a kind of strange animal. One literally never saw them except in the guise of prisoners, and even as prisoners, one never got more than a momentary glimpse of them, nor did one know what became of them. His conclusion was something forgotten until I went back and read it not too long ago. It was all right. Everything was all right. The struggle was finished. He had won the victory over himself. He loved Big Brother. The Bush administration says this war on terrorism is going to go on indefinitely, for at least the next 10 years. And the war to take back our rights is now. Thank you very much.
Small pockets of people across the country who felt as we did, but most people either were not aware at all about the Patriot Act, or they didn't think it applied to them because they weren't doing anything wrong. So even though the Patriot Act was passed by the federal government, it was having its impact on people within their local communities, and we decided to tackle it from where we were in Northampton, Massachusetts. And Bill Newman was part of this committee that formed around November of 2001. We decided that what we would do is first educate the community, collaborate with our local government, and pass a resolution that stated what we saw were the problems and to protect the civil liberties of our local people. And then we wanted to move on to expand the movement nationally and ultimately meet with our congresspeople at the national level to present the resolution and to ask for their leadership in amending the Patriot Act. So in Northampton, we organized ourselves as the Northampton Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Bill explained about how the USA Patriot Act came to be named. Well, we called ourselves the Bill of Rights Defense Committee because we figured how could Ashcroft come after a group called the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. We held a forum in Northampton that was attended by 400 people. And to counteract the suppression of dissent, we had buttons for sale, like this one, that say, "Dissent is patriotic," and they had a flag on it. If you'll remember, after September 11th, everyone was driving around with flags on their cars, and they had flags on their doors and flags on their building, as if you raise the flag, you're patriotic. But we decided, if you're patriotic when your government is in the wrong, you speak out about it, and you do something about it. And we wrote a petition and collected over 1,000 signatures from Northampton residents. We worked with city councilors, drafted a resolution, and mobilized the community to show their support. And I should mention that there was, at the city council meeting when it was voted on, a Smith College senior, I believe, was one of the people, as well as one who spoke in favor of the resolution, which passed unanimously. And we also worked with people in Amherst and Leverett and in Cambridge on similar resolutions. By spring of 2002, four Massachusetts cities and towns had passed resolutions to protect civil liberties. And next we took the movement national with a website that shared with the general public what we had done and information about the national movement and how people could get involved. We put documents up and basically a timeline for how to go about passing the resolutions. Gradually, people did find the website. They wrote things like, "Oh, bless you, I'm so happy you're there," because people felt isolated all across the country. And here was a way that a few people from a community could mobilize and educate their whole community and ultimately pass a resolution and protect themselves and their other fellow residents. So as of today, 89 communities have passed resolutions in the United States. One, Arcata, California has passed an ordinance, which is actual law as opposed to resolution, which is usually just expressing sentiment. And we don't just count the cities and towns that have passed resolutions, we count the populations of those communities, which we call civil liberties safe zones. So, so far, we have 6.5 million people in the United States who are protected by civil liberties safe zones resolutions. And I'll read an excerpt from one of the resolutions that was passed in, it's from Eugene. City Council of Eugene says, "We ask that the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, state police, and any other federal, state, and local law enforcement report to the City Council the extent and manner to which they have acted under the USA Patriot Act and new executive orders, including the names of any detainees held in the area, the charges lodged against each detainee, the name of counsel representing each detainee, the number of search warrants executed in the city without notice to the subject of the warrant, the extent of electronic surveillance carried out in the city under powers granted in the USA Patriot Act, the extent to which federal authorities are monitoring political meetings and religious gatherings, the number of times education records have been obtained, the number of times library records and records of book purchases have been obtained, and subpoenas issued to Eugene citizens through the United States Attorney's Office without a court's approval or knowledge. We resolve that to the greatest extent legally possible, no city resources will be used for unconstitutional activities conducted under the USA Patriot Act or recent executive orders which permit the activities listed above. And it is finally resolved that the City of Eugene urges members of the Oregon Congressional Delegation to actively work for the revocation of any sections of the USA Patriot Act, proposed new legislation and executive orders which limit or violate fundamental rights and liberties embodied in the municipal ordinances of the City of Eugene and the constitutions of the State of Oregon and of the United States. And if you'd like a copy of this, I brought some literature that looks like this. The back of it is this resolution. I have a little side note about Eugene. Their city council at the last minute before this vote was taken, maybe a week or so before, said we're not going to vote on this resolution. We're going to do maybe a letter to Congress, and whichever city councilors want to sign it can do so, but we're not going to vote on the resolution. So the woman who had been leading this movement called me up. She was panicked and said, what do I do? And I said, well, use your base. She had been working with a number of people at Brigham out for this meeting. So she did. They made calls to city council beforehand, and more than 400 people showed up. They, not even half of them could fit in the city council chambers when the vote was taken. And of course, Oregon is 3 hours behind us. I couldn't wait the next morning to find out at noon or whatever time whether this had passed. So I looked it up on the web and found the Oregon newspaper. The headline read, Eugene City Council gives in to a stampede of residents, surprising even themselves by voting unanimously for a civil liberties resolution. So it just shows, I think, the power that you do have if you make up your minds that you're going to take action. So the impact that we've had so far with this movement going national is that movement is growing much faster than it was at first. And we're in a more hospitable climate, I think, than when the Patriot Act was first passed. Last year, the TIPS program was deleted by Dick Carney from legislation, and Congress has at least put a few stumbling blocks in the path of the Defense Department's Total Information Awareness Program. As for federal legislation, Bill's already mentioned House Bill H.R. 1157, the Freedom to Read Protection Act, which Congressman Bernie Sanders introduced partly as a result of a resolution that was passed in Burlington, Vermont, which also involved a lot of librarians who spoke before the city council. And so this new bill would require the FBI to actually show probable cause and get a regular warrant, I believe, before they could request bookstore and library records, and it would, of course, get rid of the gag order against librarians and bookstore owners. Employees. So we think that the grassroots movement will help to ensure that this bill passes, and we hope that it will be the first of many such bills. And hopefully the existence of the grassroots movement, which of course was not around when the Patriot Act was voted on, can help ensure an open, productive national debate if and when the Justice Department introduces its draft of the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, Patriot 2, to Congress. Gradually, people are becoming better informed about the movement and about the issues, and it's receiving more attention in the mainstream press. The front page feature article about this movement in today's Washington Post, and a front page story in December in the New York Times. And our website, which is bordc.org, gets an average of 1,000 visitors day. That's not hits, that's actual people. So, and it's growing all the time. I think the grassroots movement should make more people aware of the dangers of throwing back rights, and so more people are concerned about what's happening to innocent people as a result of the Patriot Act and executive orders, and they're taking action. So what to do as students? Students, of course, community members as well as students, but I've already talked about what community members can do, and there are special privileges available to you as students. There isn't a student movement, or it's just in the beginning stages. One resolution I think was passed in Wisconsin back in 2001, but I'm not aware of movement. I've made a short list of some of the things that students should be concerned about and can include if you decide to do a petition or a resolution to your administration. And they include, of course, the ability of the FBI to seize reading lists and computer records from libraries and bookstores, as already discussed. The chance of liaisons to the FBI and FBI agents being on campus, questioning people or conducting surveillance without probable cause. And I believe if we have our next speaker, she might a little bit about this CBIS system, which all colleges and universities that have that receive any public funding are required to enter tons of information on international students that goes directly to the FBI and creates a problem where even a clerical error could result in a student being deported as a result of error. It has a lot of foreign students, of course, very bright that everything they're doing on campus is potential for them expelled from the country. The lack of knowledge, of course, is about what surveillance is going on and how it's being used, and the impact on studies and on our society in general in this country. When visas for students and professors from certain countries are being delayed or entirely denied, what kind of society will we have if we're not letting people come to this country from certain other nations just based on their racial or ethnic background? How does that from understanding the rest of the world? And finally, the chilling effect on free discourse, research, writing, and even reading and internet research when you worry about all these uncertainties. So I hope that you will get involved and will maybe talk to students on the other five college campuses to perhaps get together and think locally and act sort of globally or at least regionally as we did in Northampton, and start a student movement in this country. It would be wonderful if Northampton was the starting place not only of the Kennedy Bill of Rights defense movement, but also of a great nationwide student movement. We at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee would be very happy to support you in any way we can, including putting out a special webpage for students. And we can talk more about this in the discussion. But finally, I would like to close with a quote from Margaret Mead that I've used to describe the people across this country who have been active in the movement to restore civil liberties. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Thank you very much.
Make it that clear is really a skill, so I want to thank you for that as well. after September 11th, several new measures have been implemented that similarly focus on immigration policy for improving national security. These measures have not been shown to be effective at making us safer, and instead have had a devastating impact on non-citizens in the United States, especially in Arab, Muslim, and South Asian communities. There is a real threat to the United States. I don't think that anyone can deny that there are threats that we don't know about at this time. And the government does have a responsibility for ensuring our safety. But changes that have taken place since September 11th have not been proven to be effective at ensuring our security, and instead have undermined fundamental tenets of our democracy in many, many ways, and have stifled debate, which is the most important thing to keep a democracy healthy. Today, as I said, I'm going to present a number of immigration policies that you should be aware of, especially for those of you who are foreign students. Taken individually, some of them might seem innocuous, but if you take a step back and look at the changing landscape since September 11th, you'll see a big picture that emerges as an erosion of civil liberties and rights for all Americans, including non-citizens. With respect to immigration, the tone of immigration policy has shifted to a heavy emphasis on enforcement. The government is now enforcing immigration law on a much broader scale, and now the INS itself has been transferred into the Department of Homeland Security along with 21 other federal agencies. So just the mere placement of the INS under the broad rubric of the Department of Homeland Security already shows you what kind of tone immigration policy is going to have moving forward. It's going to focus on Homeland Security. This casts a on immigrants, characterizing them as suspects immediately. Just the mere idea of immigration has this overtone of threat to security. So I'm going to talk about a few of the immigration provisions, a couple of the things that are in the USA Patriot Act. The USA Patriot Act made numerous amendments to current immigration policy. And one of the major concerns about the USA Patriot Act is the broader definition of terrorism that Bill mentioned, which now includes the use of any weapon or dangerous device to cause substantial damage to property, and it mentioned that can mean a broad range of activities. This has significance for immigration because it has consequences in terms of people not being allowed to enter the country or people being deported from the country. There are new grounds of inadmissibility to the United States in the Patriot Act. Now, some of this is dry legal language, but I'm going to go through it anyway because it does show you the kind of weakening there has been in immigration policy in the USA Patriot Act. New grounds for inadmissibility include persons who are representative of a political, social, or other group whose public endorsement of acts of terrorist activity, keeping in mind the broader definition of terrorist activity, the Secretary of State has determined undermines United States efforts to reduce or eliminate terrorist activities. So I'll say it again because it's kind of technical, but a person who is a representative of a political or social group whose public endorsement of acts the Secretary of State determines undermines the United States efforts to reduce or eliminate terrorist activities. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, I wouldn't know what behavior is precluded in order to ensure my ability as a potential immigrant trying to get into the United States. Additionally, Patriot Act added broad new elements to the definition of terrorism itself. Solicitation of funds or other things of value for a terrorist organization designated by the Secretary of State, or for undesignated groups unless the person can show that he did not know that the solicitation would further the organization's terrorist activity. That's a mouthful, so I'm just going to kind of parse it out a little bit. Basically, provision of any kind of material support. Material support can be charitable donations, it can be sending education materials, it can be a number of things very broadly defined to an organization that is designated by the Secretary of State as a terrorist organization. Now, this designation is also, you know, very technical, and I'm not going to go into the rules of how the Secretary of State can designate an organization as a terrorist organization. But there are some rules that allow for the Attorney General to suggest such designation for certain groups. So contained in the Patriot Act itself is broader authority for the Attorney General to suggest to the Secretary of State that certain groups might be designated. So a possible scenario might be that a political organization that has, you know, some tactics that tend to create disorder, such as, you know, so a lot of civil disobedience activities, things like green organizations like Greenpeace or PETA, the Protection of Equal Treatment of Animals, that have aggressive tactics in civil disobedience could fall under these definitions. Also, the Patriot Act adds new grounds of deportability. So, based on some of those definitions that I mentioned before, such as providing material support to a terrorist organization, you can now be deported if you are a non-citizen in the United States. The Patriot Act also contains new detention provisions. One of the hallmarks of the post 9/11 Department of Justice strategy has been to use the immigration system in lieu of the criminal justice system, and to use the immigration system's detention policies and the lesser restrictions in detention policies to detain individuals with kind of a detain first, ask questions later approach. Has given the Department of Justice tools to detain individuals based on immigration violations and try to seek information that would then lead to clues for them to follow in terrorist investigations. And you know, we saw this play out in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, as many of you probably followed in the news, when they detained more than 1,200 people, mostly Arab, South Asian, Muslim men, on routine immigration violations like visa overstays. Some were had violated their student visas by not attending enough classes, things like this, very technical violations. And individuals were detained for months and months while the FBI questioned them and looked for leads for suspects suspects of terrorist activity. So new detention provisions in the Patriot Act allow the Attorney General the power to mandatorily detain any person he certifies that he has reasonable grounds to believe is a national security risk. And reasonable grounds to believe is not defined. Also, what qualifies as certification is not defined. So the Attorney General can certify whatever that means, that he has reasonable grounds to believe whatever that means, that a person is a national security threat. And fortunately, it's sad to say fortunately, but fortunately, when the USA Patriot Act was being developed, some safeguards were put into these provisions on detention. And one of the safeguards requires that the Attorney General must make this certification or must issue some kind of a charge, immigration or criminal, within 7 days, or the person has to be released. However, instead of meeting this safeguard, the Attorney General issued regulations to expand his detention authority without even having to use the USA Patriot Act. The detention provisions in the USA Patriot Act have not been used to this day. Instead, the Attorney General relied on two regulations issued post September 11th. One was a regulation that prior to September 11th, individuals could be detained in immigration for 24 hours before a charge was required to be issued against them. One of the new regulations issued since September 11th is that this rule has been expanded to 48 hours. And not only that, but for an additional undefined, unlimited, indefinite period of time, if there is an emergency or extraordinary circumstance, which again has not been defined. So you can imagine a situation in which we believe from our research was used, at least in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and still is on the books now, to detain individuals for lengthy periods of time, months on end, simply because of the terrorist threat or the post-9/11 climate as the definition of what constitutes an emergency or extraordinary circumstance. So this rule tremendously broadens the potential for individuals who are placed into deportation proceedings to be detained indefinitely. Another regulation expanded detention powers to the INS basically allows an INS trial attorney to overrule a decision by an immigration judge to release a person on bond. Ordinarily in an immigration deportation proceeding, an individual may request bond and goes before the immigration judge to request bond. If the immigration judge says, yes, you can post bond, that's it. The detainee can post bond and is free pending their deportation hearing. This new regulation allowed the INS trial attorneys to say, no, we want to put a stay on that decision until we can appeal your ruling. So basically that extended the period of time that the person was detained pending this appeal, completely overruling the judge's decision, which is supposed to be the neutral magistrate that determines the fate of the individual. Another policy post 9/11, the Department of Justice issued a directive that required an anti-terrorism task force to investigate and interview more than 8,000 men, 18 to 33 years old, who had entered the United States on non-immigrant visas and from countries, from specific Arab and South Asian countries. Non-immigrant visas being things like student visas, tourist visas, business visas. Another program, the Absconder Apprehension Initiative, placed new priority on tracking down people who already had deportation orders and placed those individuals into a database, which then individuals could be found and deported immediately without an additional hearing. This policy was originally targeted, prioritizes those from particular Arab and Muslim countries, but applies to more than 300,000 people in the United States. Another new policy that's frightening the immigrant communities is the fact that the Department of Justice has reversed a policy that used to forbid local police from enforcing federal immigration law. Now the policy is that the Attorney General can deputize local police to enforce immigration law. It doesn't happen automatically. There are what are called memorandums of agreement that the local localities need to sign with the federal government in order for their police officers to enforce immigration law. But the authority is scary because it puts a chill on the immigrant communities from seeking the support of the police or other services. It prevents them from calling 911 if there's an emergency. It prevents them from reporting crimes. And it has the communities in a tremendous amount of fear. On top of the fear that was already generated post 9/11 with all of the detentions and sweeps that were taking place. There are also additional penalties for non-citizens who fail to report a change of address. This is a policy that was on the books for many years but was rarely enforced. You can imagine trying to catch up on anyone who failed to submit a change of address. It would be like, you know, following everyone who doesn't change their driver's license when they move to another state, for example. It's a lot of paperwork. Now, the Justice Department has criminalized the failure to report a change of address within 10 days of moving. So now there's a criminal penalty if you're found to be out of that status. And those of you who are foreign students, you know, pay particular attention to this, make sure you report your change of address. It can have devastating consequences. Now, two of the policies that are, you know, of particular note, one being the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, otherwise known as NSEERS. This is the special registration program that you may have seen in the news a lot lately. The program has two parts. The first part requires visitors from certain countries to be fingerprinted, photographed, and interviewed upon arrival in the United States. And this happens at the airport or the border. And this part applies to many, many countries and has been much less controversial. The controversial part requires temporary visitors, students, business visitors, and tourists who are already in the United States to report to INS offices around the country for registration. This is pursuant to special call-in procedures where certain people from certain countries must report into the INS and be interviewed, fingerprinted, and photographed. It applies to men over 16 years of age from over 25 countries, and those countries, I have a list here, but they're primarily Arab, South Asian, and Muslim countries. This program has also resulted in detentions, and it has been controversial in one respect in that it's very discriminatory that it applies only to these people from certain countries, and also the fact that it's INS offices are notorious for not applying laws consistently. The policy varies from district to district depending on how the officers at that district decide they want to interpret the law. And one of the consequences of this was that in the beginning, when the program was started in Los Angeles, where there are heavy Iraqi and Iranian populations, over 400 people were detained in Los Angeles INS facilities as a result of reporting for registration. They voluntarily reported, thinking they were trying to comply with the law, and there was some technicality in their papers, such as I mentioned before, you know, students can be not taking enough classes to be in full compliance with their visa. Or, you know, some people had overstayed their visa, some people had applications for adjustment pending, were kind of in this limbo state. And any of those kinds of difficulties with your immigration status, at that point, you're at serious risk for detention. In Los Angeles, we really saw that happening. They've ironed out a lot of the kinks now, but there are more numbers of people being placed into deportation proceedings. If they're not detained, they're issued what are called notices to appear, which is the beginning document that says you need to appear for a deportation. So that has had a significant impact on communities as well. Now, the logic behind the special registration program, it remains unclear. It seems, you know, understandable that we want to be able to keep track of who's in the country and if people actually show up for schools that they say they're going to attend. But the call-in procedures have not seemed to, they're not effective at countering terrorism as the government has tried to make them out to be. If you can imagine, you know, someone who is participating in any kind of terrorist activity is unlikely to voluntarily show up and register and submit themselves to interrogation by the FBI and be fingerprinted. You know, if they've got those kinds of intentions, they're unlikely to comply with this kind of a procedure. And it has severe consequences for people who don't register. One of the problems with this policy was also that the INS failed to publicize it widely, and a lot of people didn't even know about the registration policy. Now they're having complicated decisions about, well, do I go in to register late when the law says that if you do not register, there's a criminal penalty. Again, it's criminalized. So it puts anyone whose status is in question in a double bind. And this is not just for people who are here illegally, I should tell you. This is for people who are in, their status is currently being adjusted, or they have some other, you know, they might even be in the middle of proceedings to try to rectify their immigration status. So this isn't people that are trying to hide from the law. The registration policy is bringing in people who are, you know, honestly trying to comply with the law. Another policy that Nancy mentioned briefly is SEVIS, which is the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System. The goal of this system is to ensure that students and exchange visitors have visas to come to U.S. schools show up and register at the school and properly maintain their status during their stay. That doesn't seem like an outrageous request. It seems fairly reasonable. But it's a massive program and a very large bureaucratic effort. And one of the biggest concerns about this program is that innocent students may be adversely affected by bureaucratic mistakes. There are a lot of technological flaws in the system and errors, information being entered improperly. It's unclear how to rectify those mistakes or how to take the information out once it's in. It also creates delays in processing the information that can cause embassies abroad to delay the approval of a visa, a student visa, for students who are trying to come to study. Another concern has to do with confidentiality. There have been previously great protections for student privacy, and this has eroded some of those protections, and that it transmits personal information about foreign students to the federal government, including the FBI. There are also concerns about difficulties that might happen when a person on a student visa goes home to visit for vacation or summer break and tries to come back. Are there going to be difficulties trying to come back to school? And hopefully some of these problems will be resolved as the system gets kind of worked through, but it's a massive undertaking, and there are still many flaws that are in this system. And so, I mean, I would recommend if there are anyone here tonight that are on student visas, you should really be careful that all of your papers are in order, and that all of your you dot every I, cross every T with your paperwork, because the new system that has emerged post 9/11 is one heavily focused on enforcement, and any kind of glitch in your paperwork, it is going to be picked up on more likely than not, and it could cause problems. There have been some, you know, seeming isolated incidents, although more research needs to be done on how this information system is actually impacting foreign students. But there have been some cases of individuals being arrested because of mistakes in the SEVIS system. Things like a student who was arrested because she was arrested for misidentifying herself as a student of San Francisco State University when she was really attending the University of San Francisco. And things like this are not, you know, it's not a terribly criminal act that she did, and yet she was arrested because of this error in the SEVIS system. There was also a student at Southeastern University in D.C. who the school mistakenly reported to the system that she had dropped out, but she had not dropped out, and there was no way to correct the mistake. So these kinds of things are things to watch out for. Types of information that are required in the SEVIS system, and your school should have a policy on this. Schools are supposed to be in compliance with the SEVIS program by August of this year. So the school should have a policy on it. Type of information required include your current address, any changes in your address, your legal name or any change in your legal name, follows your graduation dates, whether or not you graduate within that time, any changes to that, any disciplinary action taken by the school against the student as a real result of criminal convictions. This again feeds into the overall enforcement mechanisms since the FBI gets this information. And also another policy post 9/11 is that the FBI can now arrest and detain based on immigration violations, not just the INS, but the FBI as well. So this kind of information can have serious consequences. All of these policies have created a tremendous amount of fear in the immigrant communities, including the fact that the FBI has been conducting these interviews trying to get information from people, especially in the Iraqi community and the Arab and Muslim communities. We haven't heard a lot about how these interviews have been conducted. Most people say that the FBI is very polite and they, you know, ask some innocuous questions and they move on. But it's unclear how this all plays, how it all fits together and what kind of information the FBI is using to then follow up on other leads. You know, they get a name, frequently is the case, they ask somebody, do you have other friends or family here in the United States that you know from home, and somebody gives them a couple of names, and then sure enough, the FBI goes and knocks on those doors as well. And this might seem perfectly ordinary, and if you don't think you're doing anything wrong, then maybe you're not afraid, but a small technical violation in your immigration status can land you in detention and possible deportation. This is a devastating experience, especially for people who've been here for many years and have U.S. citizen spouses and children and tremendous ties to the community. I just wanted to mention very briefly, Bill mentioned briefly the Domestic Security Enhancement Act. This is the policy, is a proposal actually. It was leaked by the Department of Justice to the press in February, and it has not yet been introduced to Congress. But this is what's been dubbed Patriot 2, this nickname, Patriot 2. And the reason it's got that nickname is because it takes all of those issues that Bill mentioned before and takes them even further. And I just wanted to mention some of the things that we could see if this proposal is actually delivered to Congress. And newspaper accounts seem, Justice Department officials have said that there is some kind of new anti-terrorism legislation coming soon. They won't say when. There's some indication that it won't look exactly like the leaked version, which has gotten a lot of press, and the Department of Justice is likely to kind of retreat back from some of the more glaring provisions. But just to give you a sense, Patriot 2 would authorize secret arrests of non-citizens. Post-September 11th, there were a number of sweeps and detentions, as you all may have seen in the press. There were rising numbers of individuals being detained. There's currently litigation underway. The Center for National Security Studies versus the Department of Justice is a case that's winding its way through the courts based on Freedom of Information Act litigation. The Center for National Security Studies requested under FOIA, which is the Freedom of Information Act, that the names of the detainees who were caught up in that initial mass detention in the 10 weeks following September 11th, that the names of the detainees and the names of their lawyers be released. One of the biggest problems with those detentions is the secrecy that surrounded them. And it was very difficult to get access to the detention centers. It was difficult to get access to detainees. Detainees were having trouble finding lawyers. So the Freedom of Information Act request was aimed at getting this information to try to obtain counsel for the detainees. Now, it got caught up in litigation, and now most of the people who were caught up in that mass detention have since been deported. But the federal government has been fighting the litigation tooth and nail, And in getting back to the Patriot 2 proposal, in that proposal, there's a provision that would codify the desired result that the government has. Basically, federal agencies would be exempt from disclosing the information about any non-citizen detained within the United States or any individual detained outside the United States. So this would also apply to the detainees held at Guantanamo, for example, that you may have read about in the newspapers, which has also been difficult to get information about their status. Another provision in the Patriot 2 Act would allow a U.S. citizen to be stripped of citizenship. A U.S. citizen, even born in the United States, could be stripped of citizenship if the person gave material support, like I mentioned before in the Patriot, in the first Patriot Act, material support to a group designated by the government as terrorist. This is tremendously frightening on its face. I don't think I need to explain that any further, other than saying, again, that if you're a U.S. citizen, even born here, can you imagine being stripped of your citizenship because you gave a charitable donation to an organization that you had no idea was involved in terrorist activities? That could easily happen, for example. Oh, sure. Just a couple of other things on the immigration front. It would create more additional criminal penalties for immigrants. It would make it easier for the government to initiate deportation proceedings, and it would expand the grounds for inadmissibility to the United States, as well as erode judicial review. And so I will end it there, and take any questions you might have. I also brought these flyers. Lawyers Committee had a couple of reports that detail several of the post-9/11 policies, both immigration and otherwise. I'll leave a couple for display, and then there's also a flyer on how you can get it.
There's so much information to cover, and I know some of you, maybe many of you, have to leave. But I wanted to also make sure that we had some time for those who can stay and who want to learn more, to ask our panelists specific questions that might be on your minds this evening. And we'll take questions for maybe another 15 minutes or so. I want to thank you all for a very informative and disturbing presentation. questions? Yes.
I actually have, it's a little bit of a side question. It's about the, what you were saying about the Fourth Amendment and abortion rights. Did you mention that?
Yeah, the Roe versus Wade essentially is a privacy decision, and there are a number of different opinions from the justices on it, but primarily it is based on Fourth Amendment analysis. There is a little bit of a Ninth Amendment analysis that goes into it and says these are not the only rights we have. The right of privacy, not explicit in the Bill of Rights, is in fact fundamental to the Bill of Rights, comes from a case called Olmstead, dissent in Olmstead, in which the justice said the right of privacy, no right more fundamental than the right to be left alone by the government. And that is the fundamental basis of abortion decision.
So
in fact, the government criminalizing abortion, the court ruled, essentially violated the right to be free from unreasonable searches, the woman's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. Analytically, that's what happens in Roe and Doe.
I have a question for you. Is the government tapping everyone's lines in this Patriot Act, or just like the feds? If I were to write an email that said,
the answer is nobody knows. So let's be realistic. I don't know. I think that the answer is probably not. I also think there is probably huge amounts of unanalyzed information. You have to understand the idiocy of all this. The federal government could have prevented September 11th. It had all the information. A woman FBI agent tried to tell her supervisor, and when it came out that she tried to tell her supervisor, what does the FBI do in its most glorious bureaucratic way? Press to fire. The FBI's problem was that they didn't have the information, is that they had too much information to analyze. So what does the FBI do? What's the response of law enforcement to having too much information to analyze? Give us hundreds of times more information we can't analyze. Let's get dossiers on millions of Americans. Are they doing it? I doubt it. I think that they're probably trying to keep it analyzed. On the other hand, technology is so extraordinary that they may be able to, in fact, analyze them from computers, probably in Europe, to, in fact, try to make some determinations about this chatter and what goes on. So I think they're really looking at all of our emails, and there are not enough human beings in life, but there may be enough computers in life to try to come up with systems to focus on.
I was wondering if you mentioned the Total Information Awareness Program, the U.S. Department. What's the relationship of that to the Patriot Act? I mean, is that a completely separate system being set up?
Yes, that's a Defense Department program. This is they called in former Rear Admiral Poindexter to run this program so that they could have what they call
data mining,
yes, thank you. Tons of data, and hopefully show them patterns, to pull out patterns that were similar to terrorist patterns, like the terrorist pulls his lawn too often, then if you mow your lawn too often, I don't know how they would do it. They don't know how they do it, but anyway, it's
not
there. Yeah, so Congress had no real input on this, Department's baby, and the only way Congress could assert its to write the budget out of their appropriations bill, which they tried to do, except they had this thing in it where they wouldn't provide the funding unless the Defense Department could provide enough data and information on how this would be used and so on, that they would approve it. Of course, the Defense Department is coming back with its report.
I was wondering if you could maybe help me better understand a specific example that I have, which is of a bookstore, and there may be several in Vermont, which was apparently served with such an order that you were talking about in terms of the library's bill, or whatever it's called. And their response to doing so was to say, or I guess they were asked for their records in terms of who, what kinds of books. And the response to that was to say, we're no longer keeping records, and to destroy the records that they had. That, to me, it sounds like that's a direct violation of the USA Patriot Act. Am I correct? And B, what might it mean for them and for other bookstores like them to just say, we are no longer keeping records of who buys what kind of books?
I don't know the details of that, and I really don't want to give a legal opinion on what a bookstore did. I think the destruction of records after they've been subpoenaed or demanded by a lawful process of the government probably puts the bookstore at risk, and I assume, or at least probably talked to their appropriate legal counsel on what tack they're taking. Now, I point out, there is legislation pending to revoke this part of the Freedom to Read Act, and maybe it will pass, maybe. I think it's a problem. You're looking at a contempt kind of situation if you start to destroy records under subpoena.
I think I remember reading just on a comment, I mean, just from reading the press accounts of these bookstores that have done this, I think in that context, it was done prior to any kind of subpoena or anything. It was kind of a way to prevent any occurrence of if they were subpoenaed having to turn anything over. I saw it as a really brave act by those bookstores. And I have seen accounts of some libraries pasting notices on the internet terminal saying that you know, like a warning saying anything that you look at here could be looked at by the FBI, things like that. So, I mean, there has been a big response.
I'm wondering about SEVIS, and do all, will all universities have to be compiled by, what was it, August?
I believe it's August 1st of this year, and I believe that all colleges and universities have to comply with this government program. The Inspector General for the Department of Justice, I believe, did an evaluation of the program and said that it's very unlikely that the schools are going to be able to comply because it's a huge undertaking. There's basically two parts. There's the student and exchange visitors program, which is kind of the overall program. And the new policy is the student and exchange visitor information system. So it's another one of these big databases, and it's internet-based, and the schools are supposed to, you know, type in various information about the foreign students. And also, within the registration deadline, have to report whether anyone failed to show up for classes or dropped below the course load that they're required to take, for example. But they're supposed to comply in August. It's unlikely for it to happen.
Would that end up placing different academic requirements on international students than it would on, say, students who are citizens in terms of, like, how many courses you're taking?
Well, I think, I mean, if you're...
Sorority are, in terms of their results.
Yeah. So it's basically a way of monitoring compliance with the visa requirements. So once you get a student visa, there are certain, you know, you have to go to school a certain number of hours, various requirements, there's some work authorization requirements, things like that. So it's a way of monitoring whether or not students are showing up to the schools they say they're going to. But it's a big undertaking.
Is the school in a position of policing this stuff? I mean, it seems like sort of an odd point of, you know, making sure that this happens, that it seems like it's, you know, what the school is just like, well, that's your problem to figure that out if these students are not completely complying. You know, it's like, could schools say that? I'm not quite on the question very well, but somehow it seems like it's putting the schools in a position of.
But I think I'm not exactly sure what, you know, what the rules are as far as what gives the government the right to ask the schools to do this, for example. But I know that one of the objections to the policy came from university presidents that were saying, you know, we don't want to be responsible for, you know, giving the federal government information about our students that then could land them in deportation proceedings when we're trying to be welcoming of foreign visitors and encourage international education. And, you know, examples like I said about, you know, snafus in the system and bureaucratic errors.
Yeah, aren't there like mission statements that the schools have that they have to comply with? You know, like, we can't do this because, you know, our policy and mission is this.
But what the schools can do is what the government has done in the past, for instance, conscription, is that schools must report male students who have not registered for the draft. And if they do not report that information, then they are not eligible to distribute federal funds and financial aid. So that what happens is that the government can just link that school's eligibility to distribute federal money to students. It's basically the whole students
I was just wondering if any of you have any ideas on a better alternative. I mean, it sounds like these things aren't really working very well, but it seems like they're happening. And do you have any realistic alternatives?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is there a realistic alternative? I mean, I guess to the Patriot, I mean, that, okay, the Patriot Act is bad. But
it's being implemented. I mean, do you have any ideas that are could be realistically implemented that would be alternatives to this?
Bill can help me on that. Some of the Patriot Act I don't think is totally right. We're focusing on really very
specific sections that have potential for abuse, and that were really unnecessary because the laws that were on the books prior to September 11th, as Phil has said, were sufficient to have caught all the September 11th terrorists. Money laundering, I guess, is a desirable section. That section is what includes that. Whatever. Anyway, yeah, we haven't complained about the money section, for example. But, you know, there's a danger for having everybody in this room, everybody in the country, be eligible for surveillance for having done nothing. How can they possibly get the information they need on the real criminals if they're gathering information on everybody? So it creates more danger. I mean, if you're looking for people who are only Arab and Muslim, for example, what happens if Timothy McVeigh drives up? Now, how can you keep track on of the people who are really out to do bad things if you're spying on everybody who's typing in, and this really happened on a library computer, was typing in a chat room in New Mexico, Bush is out of control, and he gets arrested and interrogated for 5 hours for that.
So it's just sort of specifics.
Yes,
exactly. The idea of the laws, or the idea of the Patriot Act, is sort of seems a little necessary. Is that correct?
That goes way too far.
I think there are two pieces of it, or maybe three. But first of all, one thing of which we created a misimpression here, and I didn't mean to, it's not just the USA Patriot Act that's the problem. There are a series of other things that have happened that the executive branch, the Bush administration, is doing without congressional approval. The TIPS program, which would have created 24 million American informants, they were going to do by executive order. The Total Information Awareness Program is a Defense Department initiative. The right to go to all of your political meetings and your religious meetings, which was prohibited by internal FBI regulations after COINTELPRO revelations in the 70s, now revoked by Ashcroft, was done by the Justice Department fiat, saying we're revoking those internal regulations, end of story. So it's not just legislation, it's also Department of Justice regs, immigration regs, INS regulations, executive branch orders out of DOJ, but also out of the Defense Department. So it's not just the Patriot Act. And when these things come up, you know, Congress passed a bill saying you can't have TIPS. You can't turn 24 million Americans into informants. That's not okay. And that was because of a public outcry. You know, when Nancy and Marty Nathan and a couple of other people started the Northampton Bill of Rights Defense Committee, I think there were one or two other places in the country that had sort of done something like this. And there are 89 municipalities we have, without any funding, have just as a grassroots movement created these directives to their government saying, not in my backyard, not in my town, not in my city. It's really an extraordinary movement. There is a lot to do, and there has been some success. It's just that you are fighting the federal government, and they are very dedicated to this stuff, and they will take everything that they can grab. And the only reason that this bill won't show up in the form that it's been floated, Patriot 2 won't show up, is because there's been an outcry. They wanted to take the temperature of the country and see if they could get away with it. And the answer to this is no, you can't. Just the way you couldn't get away with TIPS. But they're going to get a big part of it. The same way that they didn't really think they were going to get a $750 billion tax cut. But they wanted to see if they could get it. And they're going to look for $550 or $375 or whatever they can get, regardless of how much it hurts the economy, as long as they can get their corporate donors.
One of the things that Nancy was also speaking to was the municipalities. In a movement now that we helped start, basically, of people beginning to examine the impact on their own communities, that there is a beginning of a student movement, and that Smith and now, because Erica and Emily, Amelia and Carolyn are creating a movement at Smith to be able to develop a petition or resolution that Smith College could be commit to the protection of students, faculty, and staff here. And this is not the only college. Michigan, Stanford
has a really short one. Just
Michigan's got a website,
yeah.
I think. Stanford, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
couple other ones, but so you all can be part of Smith College's and potentially the Five College response to the potential infringement on our civil rights as well. With Carolyn's help, one more question.
My question actually regards this issue. I don't know how much any of the three of you are familiar with events at Smith College, but this issue has come up, especially in regard to CETUS and libraries within the past year. And the kind of mouthpiece response usually at talks like this when there's been a question and answer from the administration has been, we don't want to take a hard political position as of yet. And different people kind of hinting on ramifications, what the ramifications would be. And my question is, I mean, especially a resolution, which is essentially a statement of opinion, or an attempt to non-comply with these laws, what are, if any, the legal ramifications for Smith from trying to do that?
I think that Smith can do more than what Smith's saying. Look, I don't think that Smith can say, for example, we will not comply with this law as long as the law. But Smith can say, if we get the informational requests to our librarians, we promise you we will do the following things. Our librarians will be instructed to contact our lawyers, and our lawyers will take all legally defensible steps to protect the students and their information. They can say, if we are approached by the government with regard to seeking information regarding international students, we will notify the students, notify our lawyers, and take all legal steps possible to protect the students and the privacy and their information. If we have information about the government seeking information through our website or through our student computers, we will take all lawful steps. We will notify the students if they can and take all lawful steps to protect the privacy of the students. And we will ensure that we will not comply without having taken all lawful steps to challenge the government seeking information about our students. I think the college can do that. The question is, will the college do that? And that's something I think. I mean, you know, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee started with seven people sitting in Marty Nathan's living room. There are 5.5 million people now who are now protected by that. You can do this. You can start this. This has been an amazing thing that started in Northampton. You can start this in Smith.
So there. Well, thank you very much.